tuning in to another episode of Providence Coffee Talk. Pastor Charles here, and I'm excited in this episode because in this one, I call up our old buddy Dennis Connor, and we have a good conversation just about coffee and ministry, state convention stuff, church stuff, and it's an exciting time to get to know his heart a little bit more. So I want to encourage you, listen in and see if you can pick up a couple nuggets in there. But a couple of reminders for you about just things coming up over the next couple of weeks. Hey, don't forget that our Hanging in the Green service is this Sunday, and it's going to be incredible. Don't want you to miss out on that. Also, our Christmas family nights are happening, and then we are getting ready for Christmas Eve service and coming into the new year. And I'm excited because starting the new year, we're going to be in the book of Acts. And I'm just excited about talking about what it means to live as a church on mission. And I think you'll pick up some of that here in this podcast as well. So wherever you're at, I hope you can grab a cup of coffee, take a sip, and let's get into it together. Thanks, guys. Well, welcome back to another episode this week, Providence Coffee Talk. I'm excited because this is my first phone interview to do with anyone ever, and I thought, who better to do it with than our Region 1 North Carolina Catalyst, Dennis Connor. Dennis, say what's up.
What's up?
He's down in his house in New Bern, enjoying life, and probably trying to figure out what in the world are we going to even talk about today. So I think that's a fun time.
I'm trying to figure out what we're talking about every time I get together with you, man.
It is true. I don't know if we ever have a plan.
Yeah, we just sort of get to it.
Yeah, we just kind of, we pick up where we left off and then try to figure out anything new from then. And then I think we both walk away going, we solved nothing.
And maybe we created some more.
Maybe. Challenges. Maybe. But yeah, so I reached out to Dennis. As many of you guys know here at Providence, Dennis came in a few weeks back to speak at our Harvest Day service, and that was so great. The people really enjoyed it, and what a profound message I think that was for us too about what it means to live on mission together. And he helped us raise a good chunk of change to send out two missions as well as to do some projects in-house. So thank you so much for that again.
Awesome. Happy to be a part of it.
Yeah. So I'll tell you one of the ways that you and I know each other is actually through coffee. Mm-hmm. Right? Like you roast your coffee, I roast my coffee.
Yeah.
And so what did you roast and drink today?
Let's see. Today I had actually a blend of a couple different beans, a Kenyan bean, which a fellow staff member with the state convention, John Gordy, brought me. His one of his sons and his family. His son's family lives in Kenya near a coffee plantation. And so anytime he and his wife Pat go to Kenya, he will bring me coffee beans back. And my favorite kind of coffee is free coffee. So I had a really, really dark full city roast on that bean, and then a city roast point on a Sumatra bean. And so put those together, really, really deep, rich flavor this morning in my coffee.
So then when you, because a lot of people don't know coffee roasting like we do, or do you do more washed process or natural dry process?
I do much more natural process. I just like the flavor that comes out of a natural process bean. You know, some of the coffees I wind up with, you know, washed is about the only option. And of course, occasionally I'll roast some decaf beans, which are, you know, that's the water process involved in that too. But most of what I roast will be a natural process. And I don't know if you've ever tried any, but I've had a few different beans that have been an anaerobic natural process. You ever tried any of those?
Yes. So I have been super into anaerobics lately in honey process. Those have been kind of the ones that I've been, and there's like a, because anaerobic has a slight fermentation to it, doesn't it?
Yeah. It's, in fact, I had one Chinese coffee bean that was anaerobic process that, man, it was downright boozy tasting. Not really to my palate. So, you know, I went through that couple of pounds I bought. And the other anaerobic process bean I bought, I don't even remember off the top of my head where it was from, but the flavor was definitely more intense than a typical natural process bean, but not so much so as that Chinese bean. Natural for me, man.
So I think I first got turned onto it. I had a Brazil anaerobic one time, and it took me about two roasts to really get it dialed in the way I liked it. Of course, I'm one of those guys too. Once it starts cracking, like once it starts hitting that first crack, like if I can hear an audible like two or three of them, I'm usually starting to temp down before it rolls, and by the time it gets into its roll, I'm in a cooling stage because I want it to be just on this side of that cinnamon color. You know, because to me, I feel like that's where I extract the most flavor. Like I'm not looking for a dark coffee, like a heavy bodied dark coffee. I'm looking for something light on the palate. I'm looking for something that's got a lot of, kind of those floral notes and a lot of those kind of fruity notes to it. So I'm looking for stuff like that. But some people, man, that getting it right, real dark, that's their thing.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say maybe I'm a little weird. Actually, I accepted the fact long ago that I'm weird.
Okay. Me too. So that's good.
Well, we know why. There's an Arkansas joke there.
There's an Arkansas joke there.
But I like a wide variety of coffees, and I don't know, part of the, I love roasting just for the craft of it. And I enjoy the variations. I roast a lot of coffee for other people just because I like doing it. It's like roasting is not a, it's not a burden for me. It's therapy. I roast a lot of coffee to give away. And so kind of playing with those different, roast points, even on the same beans, is sort of fascinating to me. And then also tasting the range of flavors that will come out of a single bean. I'm just really fascinated with the variation you can get out of one bean, even with the same roaster with a different roast point. And if I remember correctly, you got a Baymore, right?
Yeah, I have three. Roaster? Yeah. So I have one that works pretty good. And then I have two that are parts right now because I don't know if it's just the way that, because each one of them has been upgraded. But I don't know if it's the way that the upgrade communicates to the there's another heating element in the top of that thing, which burns off a lot of those gases during the roasting process. But it also adds in some heat. Neither one of those seem to click on in the stage when they're supposed to. So I don't know if those elements are just burned up. And so I just haven't bought any new ones to replace all that yet. But yeah, I have three.
Yeah. It's been a while since I looked. What's the maximum capacity on the Baymore?
You can do a pound. Most guys don't. They'll only do like 300 grams at a time. Like roughly, so almost like 12 ounces. But once you factor in the percentage of weight loss with the moisture, you're good to get about like maybe 9 to 10 ounces out of that. And so I've roasted a full pound. Like I'll roast a full 16 ounces, and then I'll usually get it down to 14 ounces. And when I was selling it, then I would reduce it down to like the standard size bag of 12 ounces. And so that gave me 2 ounces to kind of keep at the house. And I would just make a blend out of that and roast that or brew that whenever I wanted to.
Yeah, I'm digging it. I'm digging it. I bought a Janae Cafe about 2 years ago, maybe.
Oh, yeah.
And yeah, you know, there's a lot of things I like about it. First, it's a drum roaster, so I love that aspect. But, man, it does take some of the variability out. It's a little more consistent than the fresh roast machine I've used before.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I'm toying with buying a new roaster and trying to convince Cindy I need to spend about $2,000 on one. she is not yet.
She's not there yet.
Convinced.
Yeah. She needs one more good cup of coffee to go. Yes. I've looked at the bullet roasters, but that price point, I'm not there yet. Because you know, for what it can do, it's great. You can hook up your computer, you can dial in your profiles, like you can do all that stuff. But for me, I really do eventually want to get back into the micro roasting where I can do it more for like, hey, here you go. Like, here's for people, like buy bulk at a time and selling it where I can. But I really want to get back into hot air roasting again, because, you know, we all start off that way. I don't care who you are. Everybody starts off with an old, old popcorn popper and some green beans. And we're like, this will work, you know?
That was me on our balcony in Chicago.
Really?
That's how it started. Yeah.
Really? Because did you start in Chicago or did you start when you were in Arizona?
I got turned on to the idea in Arizona just before we moved. Good friend of mine there, Keith Henry, used to be on the state staff with the Arizona Convention. He was a home roaster, and I wasn't aware of that till Cindy and I were over at his and Deb's house one night for dinner, and he was talking about it, and he says, you know, if I had some, I'd give you some, but all I've got right now is some decaf. I said, well, we occasionally drink decaf. We're getting old. So,
yeah.
And so he gave us some decaf that he had roasted at home, and even decaffeinated, it was by far the best coffee I'd ever had in my life at that point.
Oh yeah.
So it's like, I got to look into this. So I bought a, you know, $20 hot air popcorn popper, and you know, I roasted in the house one time, and it's like, didn't do that again. So thankfully we had a electrical outlet on our balcony, in our condo in Chicago. So I'd go out and, man, even when it's like freezing degrees, and, go up there and roast coffee. A very small batch, of course. I don't know, maybe a quarter cup.
Yeah,
I don't even know what it was in terms of
inches like or grams, but quarter cup or like a third cup at a time.
Yeah. And but now, I mean, all the coffee we drink at home, I roast, and I even, you know, I carry my coffee with me. Like I spend a lot of one night trips on the road with my work, and I'll take a little pour over electric kettle, rechargeable grinder, and then if staying longer, like at our all staff meetings, I've got one of these like camera gun cases that people travel with.
Yeah,
and I've got my Chemex in there.
Yeah,
and you know, a thermal, bottle, and then electric kettle grinder and my Chemex filters, of course. And I'll make coffee for our team. All those guys who stay, you know, if we're staying overnight in the same hotel, you know, I'll make coffee in the mornings and And there's kind of the typical crew. When we have all staff retreat in the spring, you know, we not only have our staff team there, but there'll be guys from other parts of the staff that huddle up in the room, and we'll just drink coffee and you know, chew the fat.
Well, I mean, that
to the work before the work, you know.
That's right, because that's, I mean, that's kind of how you and I even met, because I think that piece, like, especially in Chicago, I didn't know this when you were first starting, because we had just started talking about it. And I think at that point, I had already been roasting for a few years, just kind of the same thing. I'd go to thrift stores and I would find the old West Bend popperies, and which is like in the coffee roasting world, that was the holy grail of starting off. Like, if you could find one of those. And yeah, so I would buy those up like crazy. I remember driving an hour and a half when I was at a conference, and I looked up on either Craigslist or Marketplace while I was there, and I found a little thrift store that had one that it was selling for $10. And I said, hold it for me. And I drove somewhere I'd never been before, and I was like, I want it. And to me, it was just so much fun, because you could buy big sample packs from these companies and just roast different things and try it out. And I remember the first time I roasted it, I was like, this has got to be what it is. And it was awful. I roasted it in my, not my garage, I had a shop at the time, and smoked that whole thing up. Like, it was, I mean, just smoke and chaff everywhere. And it was so bad. And then I found out I had an outlet under my carport. And so I was like, well, I'm going to do that from now on. And it was so much better. But yeah, now with the Baymore, I can roast in my garage, and as long as I crack the garage door, let some of the smoke out, like, it's not too bad. But
yeah,
North Carolina, yeah, frowns, well, on you doing that though and selling it, so I don't sell it.
We're a civilized state here,
you know? Yeah, Texas didn't, Texas. Yeah, Texas didn't care. They were like, we don't care what you do, just put this label on it. I was like, all right, sweet. North Carolina, they're like, you can't, yeah, have any pets in the house, you can't do this, you can't do that. I'm like, well, I'm out, sorry.
Yeah. In my younger days, I used to complain that we were little quasi-communist, man. It's you know, Raleigh knows all things. Raleigh knows all
things. All things.
By the way, your regular listeners should know something here. You know, as you were talking about chasing those hot air popcorn poppers, those West Bends, you know, they probably already know this about you, but Reichert is like next level scavenger. He's gonna find it. He'll spend $100 on gas to go save $10 on the youth.
I mean, priorities, right? Priorities.
Yeah, it's, yeah. It don't got to make sense. It's the thrill of the hunt. That's what it's about.
Exactly. Like, making sense is optional. It's 100% optional. It's all about the deal. It's all about the deal. And I think.
Yeah, and your listeners who have a Y chromosome, they understand that.
Oh my goodness. Well, it's, you know, coffee is one of those things that kind of got us like chatting more. And and I remember we had a few moments there in Chicago where we could sneak away and go get some good coffee, and that was fun. And I mean, that was actually one of the places where we had first met, and you were at that time working for the local association alongside the Illinois State Convention in Chicago, doing church plant support. Is that right?
Yeah, I served on the state convention staff in Illinois, and had a regional responsibility for church planting. I was a regional director, so northeast part of Illinois, essentially Chicago and the surrounding suburbs, and then we worked. So I was on the state staff, worked in connection with the local association, and for people who are like really geeked out on Baptist life, I was a jointly funded missionary. So, you know, significant part of my salary and benefits came from North American Mission Board, and eventually became a North American Mission Board employee, long story, a lot of inside baseball there. But yeah, worked with church plants and church planters, generally in the region as director. Worked as a catalyst with church planters actually in the city, all the neighborhoods within right. the city. And we lived in the city most of that time, about a half mile due west of Soldier Field on the 15th floor of a condo that faced south so we could see the White Sox Stadium. Because I lived in Chicago, don't assume I'm a Cubs fan because it ain't so.
I'm about to say you're a big Sox fan, which is, they need those. They need fans, so that's good.
They just die hard on the south side, baby.
But I remember those days in Chicago. Those were always fun days because you experience, experience the world a little bit different out there than it is here. And I think for a lot of people that grow up in Eastern North Carolina, there's a little bit of protection that we have, a little bit of a shield that we have from some of the realities of the world that exists out there. And, Chicago was definitely one of those. I think that you would walk it, like, especially if you were from a small rural area, you would walk into and go, people actually live this way. Yes. and not just any people, but like you have 10 million, 12 million people, something like that, within the greater Chicago area that live that way. In fact, what is it? We were learning that most of the population of Illinois, of the state itself, is in Chicago.
Yeah. At the time, I hadn't looked at, census since we moved back to North Carolina for Illinois. But at the time, 13 million people in the state as a whole, 11 million in Chicago and the surrounding suburbs.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, that's wild. I can't.
Yeah.
And I've met a few people from that area that have grown up in that area that have moved out here. And they, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, even we here in Eastern North Carolina, we have our different things. It's like, well, I'm from Moyoc, I'm from Shawboro, well, I'm from Barco, I'm from Sligo. And I think we even unconsciously do exactly what Chicagoans do, and they create their own communities within certain areas. And and we do the same thing. It's like, well, oh, you're from Shawboro. No. I'm from Sligo. Okay, so yeah. Literally 2 miles up the road. Like, let's just call. There's a point where I'm almost just like, let's just call a spade here, and let's just say that we're from the same county or something, just to say that we have some sort of common ground. And I think that's one of the pieces that in all of humanity is like, we are so dead set on saying, well, no, I'm actually from here. Okay, yeah.
You know what was really fascinating to me living in Chicago, and it struck me pretty quickly. For all in the city, for all the population density that is there, uh-huh. And I mean, it is seriously dense. When we first moved to Chicago, we rented a place on the north side, which is what most newcomers do, in the Uptown neighborhood. And Uptown at the time, about a mile and a half square, 53,000 people, if I remember correctly.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's a few more than the whole of Currituck County's got. And then when we bought our condo in the South Loop, we were 15 blocks south of the zero point at State and Madison in the heart of the city. And then, close enough to the lake to see a little bit between, we were a few blocks in from the lake, but we could still see a little bit of Lake Michigan. And on a clear day, we could see all the way to Gary, Indiana. Not that there's much to see in Gary, but we could see it. But the thing that was fascinating to me, for all of that density and all the bigness that people think of when they think of Chicago, is that it was really a conglomeration of a lot of small communities. Like we shopped at the grocery store that was literally across 16th Street from our building. And, we could walk over there and we would see our neighbors from our condo building, and then other neighbors from like the townhomes and single family housing, just a few blocks north of us. you know, most of the dog owners in our neighborhood we knew, because we had a 60-pound Australian Shepherd, and you got a dog that size living in a on the 15th floor of a condo building, you're outside several times every day.
Yeah.
And we would see our other neighbors who also had dogs, got to know them. So we saw our neighbors at the grocery store, just like I did when I pastored Kashab Baptist Church, County Seat Church in Windsor, a town of fewer than 2,000. So, that not only seeing the same people, but one of the other things that was really interesting to me about the city is another part of the small town feel there was the way the city did things. Like from April to, I believe, November, they have street sweepers that come through. Chicago, for a big city, is really clean. Yeah. And part of the reason for that, the largest department in the city is what the locals call streets and sanitation. And so there's, they plow the streets when it's snowing, salt the streets, do all sorts of things. And then in the summer, they had the street sweepers. Spring and summer, they had the street sweepers. And there are certain days on certain streets that they run, and they would come out, I think it was like once a month or maybe every 2 weeks or something like that. But they would come out with these like thick cardstock printed posters that were probably 11 by 14 with holes in the corners and string, and tie them around trees.
Huh.
And I'm like, this is the third largest city in the nation, and we've got cardstock signs tied to trees telling us things that the city is doing. It just seems so small townish to me. It was Chicago was just a really, really fascinating juxtaposition of people and cultures and sort of the conflicting things that people think about Chicago. The reality is just so different.
Yeah, I mean, it really is, because I mean, you've got modes of transportation that are different. You've got ways in which you get around town that are different. And, but you know, when a community builds so much infrastructure around that, it's easy to do. And I guarantee you, there's people that have been born and raised in Chicago and they'll never leave, you know? So I think that you have, even in that way, you have that same kind of attitude that we have here, where it's like, what's the point in leaving? Right. I mean, I've been here my whole life. What's the point in doing anything different, doing anything else? And so, And so,
you know, something else that's fascinating to me, where I see a similarity to a place like Shawboro or maybe the whole of Currituck County in Chicago, is that people who have never been there make a lot of assumptions about what life is like there. Like, you know, somebody who's outside looking in.
Yeah.
They look at, you know, they may look at the map and see Currituck County. They may even pull up census figures and see how sparsely populated it is, and they begin to make assumptions, or, you know, they may even read something about, all the agriculture that's in Currituck County, and begin to make certain assumptions about the people there being, you know, hayseeds or something like that.
Yeah.
But man, you got a lot of really intelligent and brilliant people. In fact, yeah. I found that my first pastor in Bertie County, in one of the most sparsely populated counties in the state. I used to joke with people in Charlotte where I grew up that, in Bertie, the closest thing we had to a traffic jam was a funeral procession, and I was usually at the front of that. You know, I ain't waiting on nothing around there.
No way.
Used to also tell people we had more deer in Berkeley than we had people.
It's true. And
it was true. Yeah.
Yeah.
But you know, people make certain assumptions about a place like that. But man, I mean, the farmers that are part of Providence, you know, they're not hayseeds. They are businessmen running, you know, running substantial businesses, producing really high revenues week in or year in, year out. And also, man, with a lot of high stakes decisions to make based on, you know, their experience, you know, watching market prices and trying to anticipate what the market might do. And then of course you have people who are working for, you know, Fortune 500 companies and defense contractors and all of that sort of stuff. And so, you know, people can make an assumption not knowing a place. They make assumptions about what it's like and who the people are there.
Yeah.
But when you get there and get around them and you learn, very few of those assumptions are really right.
And that's something that Melina and I, we talk about regularly, like especially on a Sunday when we leave our church or just during the week. You know, I talk to some of these farmers and you don't realize how much not only risk that they have, like they have to do risk evaluations every single year, like to determine, like I'm about to put this tractor, I've got to spend this money on diesel, on equipment, on upkeep. I'm about to put this tractor to work and I need to make sure that from what I'm working on, that I'm going to be able to make at least a few dollars back on it. And that's every time that they get out there in the field. I mean, every single time they're driving somewhere, they're taking a risk to say, is this going to come back and produce? And then you talk to them in the science that's involved in that. It's not just, I'm going to go put a seed in the ground. I mean, it is, well, you know, what's the timing? What's the soil? What's the pH? What's the this? Because again, the goal isn't to produce a crop. The goal is to produce the best crop that you can in order to come back with the most revenue that you can so that you can seesaw that, you know, you can offset what you've put in and you can come back and you don't know what you're going to get back on it. You're literally saving back every year to hopefully come back a little bit ahead the next year. That's just like running a company. I mean, it's the same thing. We've got to invest and hope that our investment comes back to us and then some, so that we can survive. And so it's a very interesting piece when you even look at the greater dynamics of what goes on in this county. And then, like you said, we've got so many people that have moved out of Virginia into Currituck County and they work in Hampton Roads. But they don't just work. You know, they're not up there flipping burgers. I mean, they're up there running companies. Right. They're operating out of shipyards. They are serving in military service. They are doing defense contracts. They are, I mean, and it is wild the extent. And so I love telling people, because we were in Texas for 13 years. And so when people would say, you know, they ask us, hey, where do you live at over there? It's like, okay, well, you know where the ocean is? And they're like, yeah. I said, just a little bit inland from that. And so, and again, they think that everybody around here is just a bunch of surfers and we just go like lay out on the beach all day and get sun. And the reality is, it's like, no, like there's a whole world that exists out here of people that are thriving and they're making a living. And so it's so interesting because I stand up there every Sunday and Melina and I will say this. And she goes, Charles, you've got this type of person, and this type of person that do great and amazing things every single day of the week. And they come to listen to you. And I'm just like, that's like humbling, you know, because it's super humbling. And I'm so thrilled that I get to be around some of the smartest people I've ever met in my life.
Part of what I have absolutely loved about Providence is, you know, that wide variety of people who make up the church. You know, some of the, as a ministry leader in another part of Eastern North Carolina has said, you've got the been-heres and the came-heres.
Yeah.
And And the beautiful thing at Providence, I mean, I hate to say it, bro, but not every church has that mix and appreciates it, embraces it, loves it, enjoys it, thrives in it. And Providence does. And it's just fun to, it's fun to watch. That's why I like being around your people, man.
Yeah. And I think even just seeing how different it's been in just 3 years of being here, that we've had so many new faces that have, you know, come through the doors of our church, and getting to hear their stories and what they do. We've got anywhere again from farmers to blue collar workers to accountants to VPs in companies to, you know, it's such a huge spread, you know? Yeah. And I always find that to be fascinating that, our county, even then our county, like you said, our county has evolved so much. Mm-hmm. And I was talking to one of our farmers the other day. They said, "Oh, I remember when Moyock used to be one stoplight, and now they like just mm-hmm. added another one because traffic during the summer is so bad. Like you almost can't even, from the moment that people start heading down to the beach, there's a few places you just can't go in town in the summer because it's going to take forever to get there. And you know, you learn around those things, but you know, then at the same,
you know, I'm sorry.
No, I was going to say, but then at the same time, like if you want to take a day and go soak in some sun and hear the waves, you know, you're an hour away from being able to do that. So,
You know, even with all the growth, one of the realities that still just blows my mind about Currituck County is the county seat is not incorporated.
No, like not even close.
I grew up in Charlotte, man. It's a, so the notion that a county seat would not be incorporated is like, that doesn't even fit in my framework of understanding when I was younger. Like, how can that possibly be? You gotta have a town, right?
Yeah.
But hey, it's working in Currituck, man.
It is, to an extent. I mean, the hard thing I see is we are such a long county. We're not very wide, but we are such a long county. And there's a huge difference between the northern part of the county and the southern part of the county. And then when you get out on the Outer Banks side of the county of like Corolla and Corova and all that, you almost, you have this like different distinctions within that. And so you definitely have a bunch of snowbirds that can come in on the southern side of the county. And then on top of that too, you've got townspeople that are in, that are mixed in throughout that. So even church looks different. Like even church up here looks different than church down there. And I find that to be incredibly fascinating that we can be in the same county, yet the people that we reach can be incredibly different all at the same time.
And the reality, not only does church look different here and there, but you need more churches in Currituck County.
Yeah, that's one that sparks debate all the time. I usually get in trouble when I start talking about that. And I think part of it is we've got a lot of great churches and church facilities. Sure. But, you know, of course, you and I, we've talked about this. I've been very passionate about seeing every church in Currituck County multiply and grow. I mean, that's just been a huge passion of mine. That in Camden County, you know, wherever I'm at. And that's one of the things I love about partnering with Terry and our state convention is working alongside churches and just saying, hey, let's help you grow in the unique gift that God has for you. And let's see you multiply during this time. And I think we've seen the benefit of some of that here at Providence. And I want to see other churches be able to experience that as well, you know? So let's talk, since we're on state stuff real quick, let's talk, you are what they call our region one, catalyst, you and John Gordy, but, what does that kind of entail? And what is that responsibility when it comes to your role with the state?
Well, if your listeners remember back to, high school days, high school science classes. Catalyst is something that either makes something happen that wouldn't otherwise, or speeds the process. And so our role as Great Commission Catalysts in the region is to walk alongside local churches like Providence or local associations like the Chowan Association to catalyze Great Commission work. And you know, the Great Commission work really comes down to the way I would define it is introducing people to Jesus or growing people in Jesus and finding ways to do that that, you know, reflects our local mission field, our community. You know, there are certain things we all anticipate will be the same. At some point, we got to get to evangelism. At some point, we got to share the gospel with folk. And how that happens in a local community like Shawboro might be different from local communities, say, in Winterville in Pitt County, you know, where a pastor, a fairly new pastor, just I think he'd been there 7-8 months now. This one at the stake, I mentioned anyway, he said, you know, Diz, it may seem a little old school, but you know, my wife and I just go knock on doors and talk to folk, get to meet them. They also do some event evangelism where they're doing community events on a regular basis. I think about quarterly, something like that.
Yeah.
To invite people to something just to serve the community in some way. They had a block party, I think, back in before school started back. And you know, some hamburgers, hot dogs, some games and that kind of stuff, just to cultivate relationships and build trust. So what that looks like in each community might be different. You know, I had a pastor recently, I say recently, probably back in the spring, say to me, hey, our church is engaged in this, this, and this. But as we think about how we become an Acts 1-8 church to be Jesus's witnesses in our Jerusalem, our immediate community, Judea, the surrounding region, Samaria, what I like to call the people we don't like or
right.
have been trained to hate,
right.
and then the othermost parts of the world. And he said, you know, the pieces were, I think were, missing is that Samaria piece. And he said, we also want to be engaged in church planting some way. And so he said, I want to be involved in some community, involved in church planting in some communities very different from our own.
Yeah.
And I also want to begin to cultivate relationships with an unreached people group that's represented here in the U.S. And I told him, I said, well, there's probably a lot of places in the U.S. you could do that. But one place I know for sure you can is Chicago. So yeah. I took a handful of guys to Chicago. And so what we do looks different for each church. You know, it's not our role to go in and tell a church what they ought to do. I'm just not that sort of person to start with. And our state convention as a whole, I mean, from our founding in 1830, and if your math is good, you know, it's soon going to be 200 years.
Yeah.
When the state convention was formed in Eastern North Carolina, by the way, in Greenville, the stated purpose was to assist churches in their divinely appointed mission. That comes straight from the Articles of Incorporation, 1830. So as local churches understand what their divinely appointed mission, that is the Great Commission, how that's played out for them, our responsibility and opportunity really is to come alongside them and say, hey, this is who you are, this is what you aspire to do. How do we get from here to there? And you know, sometimes that's a simple conversation. Sometimes it's meeting with a group. I had a meeting, you know, probably back in the spring, I think, about a 1 hour, hour 10 lunch meeting with a church in Camden County. And most of what I did, I don't know, the first third of that meeting was just asking them questions, trying to understand, you know, a little bit about the church. But just asking a variety of questions and then putting on the table some options and possibilities, and they're pursuing those now. So, again, the work comes in a variety of ways. You know, part of what I love about it, if the work was just stamping out widgets every week, I'd go out of my mind.
Yeah.
But the variety of people, the variety of communities, how some of our communities in Eastern North Carolina are changing is, you know, we may not see the pace of growth that's happening in Charlotte, for instance, on the Triangle. But in virtually every part of Eastern North Carolina, there are some new people who are coming from places that are not typical. You know, it's not like they're moving from the next county.
Right.
You know, in some cases, we're seeing people move across country from California to Eastern North Carolina. And that presents, you know, challenge and opportunity for our local churches to say, how do we reach them? How do we understand them? How do we communicate with them based on their values and understanding their starting place, if you will?
Yeah.
And so again, that means every community is going to look a little different, and that means every day is different. And that keeps me jazzed, man.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's kind of the neater piece too, of even where we're at as a church. You know, we're right now with our leadership team, we're beginning the process of discovering, you know, what do we find to be valuable as a church? What do we, you know, we have some things that are listed, and we've brought those things out. And I told them from the beginning, I said, everything that we have done up to this point, let's put that on the table and let's consider it. But let's be dictated by where the Holy Spirit's leading us through this. And let's work really hard to be authentic to who we are. And so we're determining values right now. And one of the things that keeps creeping up, I think, through this process is, you know, okay, well, where are we heading next? Like, what's our next piece of that? You know, in January, we're going to begin the book of Acts in January, and we're going to really theme out this next year to kind of, help remind us, okay, what does it mean to be a church that's on mission? Like, what does that look like? Yeah. And then hopefully during that time as well, we're developing through Providence, okay, through this leadership team, what does Providence look like on mission? And then if there's some areas that we need to fill that gap in, where do we begin the process of filling in that gap? Where do we do that? And I think those are some of the unique things that we're getting ready to undergo, because kind of that same Acts 1:8 mindset, I think that we could do a really great job in our own backyard. And I think our people have the heart for that, and they're kind enough for that. Like, I've yet to see them not warmly greet someone or encourage someone to be a part of the fellowship with us. But then thinking like, okay, well, there's even areas where we could assist other churches in our community, but even other churches in our state. And there's areas outside of our country where we could assist people as well. So what does that look like? But I think the bigger piece of what we're trying to accomplish through that is we're not trying to tell them that missions is a program. Missions is a DNA, you know. Missions is, you know, 'cause when we consolidate missions down to a program, then we essentially say, well, this is, you know, then church becomes a program, and then Bible study becomes a program. And then, but when it's just something that's incorporated into the DNA of who you are, you don't have to program that. It naturally begins to flow out of who you are as a church. And so I think those are some pieces that are are big reminders for me of how we as a church have a responsibility to not only our own community, but we also have a responsibility to whoever God has placed on our mind and in our care. And so,
yeah, you know, that's part of what I love about short-term mission trips. It allows people, you know, no matter how healthy, wonderful, thriving a local church community is, it gives them an opportunity to experience life on mission in a different place, with different people, in a different culture and environment. And oftentimes it actually opens their eyes to the opportunities they have before them. You know, when we were planting in Arizona years ago, we would have, each year we'd have sometimes as many as 12 volunteer teams come out and help us. I mean, there was one year when Halloween fell on Saturday and we do a big fall festival, we actually had 91 people from 8 different churches come help us with that one weekend. That's when my administrative acumen took a huge leap. I had to figure that out. You can't just have 91 people show up and say, okay, let's see what we're going to do.
Yeah.
Had to be a planning place. But anyway, I digress. We had several of those churches. One in particular, came from Kershaw, South Carolina, not far from where Cindy grew up. And just spending time with us and engaging with the people we were reaching and seeing how some of those community-focused events helped us build relationships, that prompted them to go back and begin to do a variety of those things in their community. And one of the things I think is changing in the Bible Belt of the South, the culture, there are places, this pastor I was telling about earlier that he was going door to door, and I told him many pastors over the years have asked me, do I think door to door ministry or door to door evangelism still works? And to a person, I've always said, the only people I've heard say it doesn't work are people who have never done it. Yeah. But there's also an element in our changing society where, we have reduced trust in institutions because just because, Providence sits on that piece of property on the state highway in Shawboro does not mean to everyone in Currituck County it's worth their trust. Trust today is so often built on the foundation of a relationship.
Yeah.
So they get to know you. They get to know what's important to you. They begin to see common ground. They watch you, hear you, see your life. And not only you, but the people in the pews at Providence, the folks that they work with, go to school with, shop with, all of that sort of thing. As we cultivate relationships with them, we're constantly building trust. And with that trust comes what I call relational authority. So that whenever the time comes, a crisis in their life or just a turn in the conversation, an opportunity to take their mind in an eternal direction, to speak some truth about the gospel and what the Lord's done in our lives and how he's used us, how he's blessed us, his goodness and grace and faithfulness to us. However it may happen, with that relationships there, we share that from a place of relational authority. And another thing that I love about taking that approach, it is what I call evangelism by exhortation. Many of us who grew up in church like myself and sometimes mistakenly believe that exhortation and encouragement are the same. I think they're related, but still very different. Encouragement I describe as shouting or cheering someone on.
Yeah.
Whereas exhortation, it literally means to call alongside. So exhortation is not cheering someone on, but bringing someone along.
Yeah.
And so when we cultivate those relationships and share the gospel, speak biblical truth from a place of relational authority, we are exercising what I call evangelism, exhortation. We're calling them alongside us to say, go with me. And I think where we are as an American society, man, that may be a longer road. It's certainly a harder road than just what I sometimes call drive-by evangelism. And again, not suggesting that somebody ought not do that.
Yeah.
In fact, I've often said the best approach to evangelism is the approach we use. But I think it's a longer road. It's a harder road. It brings a greater responsibility to us as we interact with other people. Uh-huh. But I also think it is a far more effective approach in today's American society. Earn the trust and be heard from a place of relational authority.
Yeah. I mean, I think that those things, echo what the church needs to prioritize. I think that those are the things that we have to kind of step back and say, okay, as a church, we must understand that the idea of, and I don't want to say it's completely false, because I've seen that the narrative can change, you know, week in and week out, depending on where people are at. But one of the things that is, you know, we used to believe that just because the doors are open, people should come. And that they're just going to naturally stop in because we're a church. But people no longer, I think the community outside, they still see church as existing in a facility. But I think they are recognizing that the church is more made up of the people. And they want to know, are these people going to accept me for as I am, you know, apart from the building, but are the people going to accept me? I think that's where that trust and that vulnerability comes in. And we have to be willing to do that. And that's why I always tell our people, I'm not asking you to be perfect. I'm asking you to be willing to walk alongside somebody else. And we figure this out together, because we were not created to know everything. That was the lie of deception in the garden. And that's the lie of deception now, that we have to know everything, or that we have to obtain the understanding before we can obtain the salvation. That's just not true. The salvation's there for us. We just have to accept it.
You know, it's, one of the things that, became clear to me over my years of walking with Christ, you know, being a student of scripture, is that, you know, so many people think they're messed up and they're right. But of course, that's why we have so much in the New Testament. I mean, the epistles were written
in
many cases to straighten out jacked up people.
Yep.
So, you know, it's where we learn not only about what it means to follow after Jesus, but in the midst of those, like, you know, Romans, Galatians, Ephesians, et cetera, we have those reminders, those glimpses of biblical theology that helps us understand who he is, what he's done, and our life is just simply a response to that.
Yeah. Well, and I think those things are evident, man. They're true. And I think that that's a good kind of, we're approaching the hour mark. So that may be a good quick. So, and we may have to just jump in and do another one again. Maybe when I can catch you in person, we could do one in person, and then we'll follow up with some more of this. But I mean, I think that's a good takeaway for us today, that the reality is that all we've got to do is be willing to be used. to be willing to let the Holy Spirit use us in whatever capacity he has us in, and trust that the giftings that he's already given us are sufficient enough to see others come to an understanding of Christ and an understanding of that relationship. So even if we feel like we are messed up in an area, that may be something that God uses to bring other people who are also struggling in that area to say, hey, let's not struggle together. Let's figure this out together. And I think that relational aspect is going to be huge to see churches continue to grow in our area and in our community. So,
yay, invariably.
Yeah. Yeah. Any other final thoughts, man?
Hey, I see the next time we get together, you know, get together there in Currituck County, I'll bring my electric kettle and Chemex you know, we'll have coffee and conversation.
Yeah, we'll actually have real coffee. Yeah, I'm staring at my 10 cup Chemex right now.
Oh, dude, you're killing me.
Oh, it's so great. I love it. So, well, all right, man. Well, hey,
thanks for the opportunity.
Yeah, bud, not a problem. And again, any of you guys that are listening, if you've got any thoughts or comments, man, please send them my way. And if you are interested in ever being recorded on one of these, just, you know, again, you don't have to have all the answers. We've just been sitting here chatting for the past hour. So, but man, thank you guys so much for tuning in, and we'll catch you guys next week.